Muller House Meeting, Sunday afternoon, 7th October, 1979. It is impossible for all who are sensitive not to have been profoundly impressed by the beauty of the autumn today. The wonderful colouring and the extraordinary beauty and the peace of everything around. It seemed, to me at least, to be so mellow, so meek, and I deliberately use the word meek in this context, because the word meek, as used in the New Testament, means to be tamed and trained. Praos, the Greek word, was used by them, by the Greeks, with reference to the taming and training of a colt upon which they rode. And you will remember that Jesus says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Now, when oneself, a human being, is tamed and trained and made meek, he enters into his own kingdom, the earth. And the earth is the term used to signify his own living person, the psychophysical organism. And it has a profound meaning. And one associates it with autumn, when maturing is taking place in a manner which shows this coming to fulfillment and the beauty of that coming to fulfillment. The relinquishing of all that went before, the heat and the struggle of achievement and attainment, and so on and so on. For us, as human beings, as it was said yesterday, the body is brought to maturity through the activity of Mother Nature. And thereafter, nature hands over to us the responsibility for maturing the psyche first, and through the purification and maturing of the psyche, the mind comes to fruition. It is necessary that we should understand what we mean by the use of the words mind and psyche in the religious context in relationship to a human being. All the world uses the word mind. But do we know what mind is? What exactly do we mean by mind? Ordinarily, all our mental processes, as they are called, our feelings and thoughts, our emotions, our ideas, and so forth, they are called mental processes, constituting our mental life. Now that is the ordinary view of the word mind. But in the deep religious context, if you look very carefully into the great scriptural writings of all the great religions, certainly five of the great religions, you will discover that the word mind really stands for one archetypal form of the primordial creative energy acting in eternity, which releases cosmos out of chaos. That archetypal form of the one primordial creative energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. We have, for instance, in Genesis, the statement as translated, rather poorly translated, I feel, into English, by the words, "And God said, let there be light, and there was light." It would be much better if it were translated, "And God minded, and that mind brought forth light," which is a very different thing altogether. When we use the word God, we are talking of the context of transcendence, of infinity, of eternity, of immortality. So, this archetypal form of primordial creative energy, of which we know nothing, in releasing cosmos out of chaos, used that aspect of itself which has the power to form a universe which obeys its own laws implicitly. And this divine law, in the Rig Veda it was called Ritta, is inherent in every single thing or creature throughout all creation. Now we have therefore the idea, when presented this way, that mind is a universal energy. It has no characteristics which we can ascribe to it. A universal energy. Side by side with that, there is the functioning of another archetypal form of primordial creative energy, which gives rise to what we have called through the centuries, matter. Concrete matter. Mind gives it form and law and order. And this archetypal form of the one creative energy gives rise to the substance which is shaped by mind. So, consider, for example, the physical body alone. This, which is an aggregation of solids, liquids, gases, etc., is the manifestation of universal corporeality, of universal matter. That energy interacting with the energy we call mind gives rise to our particular form of manifestation mentally. That is, our feelings, our thoughts, and so forth. And this I prefer to define as psyche. Now, the psyche has characteristics. It is your particular manifestation of mentality. Mind itself is transcendent, universal. Psyche is particular, finite, mortal. It is very useful to regard the situation this way, because if we do so, with our own intelligence, we can begin to penetrate a little more deeply and understand how the context of the divine, of the transcendent, is related to the context of the worldly. The context of the immortal and the eternal can be conjoined with the context of the finite and the mortal. So we'll bear that in mind as we go on. So now, when the psyche, which manifests all our faults and so forth, is completely purified, it becomes completely transparent to the light of transcendence. And then this universal energy, mind, which is the divine mind, what we have called in the scriptures the divine mind, functions freely through you, the psychophysical person. Hence the necessity for purification of the psyche. Now, the particularity of the psyche is dependent upon the particularity of the body. Each person's body is unique. One's brain, nervous system, the ductless glands and their operation and so forth, the entire electrochemistry of the body determines the way in which we will manifest our psychical life. So you see, the psyche is yours, individual and unique. Mind, with regard to mind, as understood in this way, is not yours, not mine. It is the universal divine mind. We can never say my mind. And we can really, although we all do, never say my God. God may say my man, but I cannot say my God. I have no possession, no rights over the divine. Now, this enables us to understand a little more deeply the meaning of the word human. H-U, and man, man. It's derived from the Sanskrit root man, which is usually translated in the dictionaries of the world as to think. Man is the root for to think. What happens when we read the dictionary meaning? We immediately imagine that it refers to our thinking process. It doesn't. What is our thinking, so-called? It is merely a string of conversation, of talk, of words. not spoken aloud. That is what we call thinking. Some people say, oh no, I think in pictures, not in words. But if you ask that person, well, how do you know what your pictures mean? He will begin to see that in order to ascribe meaning to the succession of pictures, he has to give a verbal description. And therefore, it comes down to the same thing. Or if a person says, oh no, I think in terms of music or sounds and so forth, how does he understand the succession of sounds which he calls music? Again, it comes down to words. The verbal aspect is extraordinarily important and plays a dominant part in what we call thinking. But the words of our language are our manufacture. And we have manufactured language and words in terms of time after we came into being on this planet. Does the one primordial energy talk like we do in words? Not at all. So you see how we are restricted and limited when we try to enter the realm of the divine. We misinterpret that realm all along the line. And this has always been one of the very great stumbling blocks and difficulties in understanding in terms of truth and actuality what the scriptures have presented to us. That is to say, what the scriptures have tried to present to us. So now, we come back to this word human. If you regard man, the root, to mean to mind in the sense in which I have tried to present it to you, I don't suggest for a moment that what I have tried to present is the truth. I should be remarkably conceited if I did. But perhaps it is a help to put it in this form. So now, man meaning minded, that is to say, using creative energy in this particular archetypal form to release cosmos. Therefore, if we say, and God minded, let there be light, and there was light, what happens is that the supreme creative energy, utilizing its own power in this particular form, released cosmos, released light, and so forth. Do you begin to sort of sense what underlies all this? And the prefix hu, which in Sanskrit and Pali it is usually su, su, the s and the h can be interchanged. And that means happy, blissful. So, if we translate the word human along these lines, the meaning of the word human is the blissful creator. That is its full meaning. And as and when a human being comes to his full fruition and the psyche is completely purified and his mental life has really reached its maturity, then he is completely at one as a finite instrument of the infinite divine creative power. And that is the meaning of the word human. Now, when we talk about these things, we tend to separate the divine and the transcendent from the mortal, the worldly, the human, as we call it. And this is a profound error. There is no separation in actuality. Actually, there is but one total reality, unthinkable, unimaginable, the absolute all, of which we can understand a certain tiny fraction only. Whatsoever appears to us as different and separate or opposite is actually subsumed in that totality. I used this word subsumed yesterday, and I suggested we might regard it as completely contained within the totality. But even contained is not a good enough word. Let me illustrate it this way. Here is a box. It has three dimensions. It has length, it has breadth, it has depth. Now, you and I, as human beings, are so constituted by nature that we are capable of being conscious of objects in space in three dimensions: length, breadth, depth. And because our normal consciousness has that much capacity, therefore we can be conscious and quite understand the meaning of no dimensions, one dimension, two dimensions, three dimensions. The three dimensions mark the limit of our consciousness capacity, so to say. Now, if you take a point, it has no dimensions at all. No length, no breadth, no depth. It is a pure concept, non-existent in ordinary material reality. But if a point moves, it produces a line. We can be conscious of a line. We can see a line as a line. One dimension. If a line moves, it produces a surface. It has two dimensions. And if a surface moves, it produces the solid object, which has three dimensions. And that marks the limit of the capacity of our consciousness with regard to the number of dimensions. So now, no dimensions, one, two, and three dimensions are all subsumed within the three-dimensional object. That means not just contained like so many articles inside a box, but all these dimensions are integrated into a whole. They are not mechanically joined together, but integrated into a living whole. Now, it is in that way that, as far as I am aware, the great scriptures of the world have tried to suggest how this world of which we are conscious in terms of finitude, finite particulars that is, of limitation, of time, time going only in one direction, temporality as we call it, past, present, future, and of mortality. Whatsoever comes into being in terms of the time consciousness undergoes development and ending, birth and death. Therefore, this worldly context, which, remember, is the way in which our consciousness functions, is the context of finitude, temporality, and mortality. But these three are integrated as a whole in our worldly context. Now, when we talk of the transcendent, we have a dim sense which makes us say that the transcendent is infinite, non-measurable. It has no limitations of any sort. It is eternal, in which time is not an opposite, but is subsumed in eternity. And similarly, timelessness is also subsumed in eternity. Time and timelessness are not the opposites of eternity. The finite is not the opposite of the infinite. The lesser dimensions are always subsumed, fully integrated into the higher dimensions, because the totality is one absolute totality only. It can't be more, it can't be less. You can't say anything about it. You see? And the context of mortality, similarly, therefore, is subsumed in immortality. Now, one can feel a certain sensitivity about this, but one cannot make thoughts about it, concepts about it. One has to speak in such a way as to help the listener to thrill inside himself to this new dimension. This dimension which is transcendence itself. It's important to understand this, because then only we really begin to sort of see some light and begin to understand why this world of continuous change and conflict and difficulty, and it is change and conflict and difficulty in our consciousness, not in absolute reality. How this world can and does undergo continuous transformation through the process of change. Now, the transformation which concerns us is the transformation of our own mode of awareness of our existence. We are aware of existence as so many separate objects and so many different persons or creatures. We are conscious in terms of differentiation, and we are not conscious fully, that is, we are not fully conscious in terms of the complete and absolute integration of what seem to be different things into one great whole, one great totality. So you see, the word human, which means the blissful creator, is a word which stands for the phrase, the Son of Mind. You know how Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man? The Son of Man is the Son of Mind, this archetypal creative energy. And the Son of Mind can grow, can emerge out of the limitation of mortality into the consciousness, the real consciousness of immortality. And therefore, he is also called the Son of God. In India, we say the Manushya Putra, the Son of Man, or the Son of Mind. Manas is mind. You see, the Son of Mind is also the Brahma Putra, the sun of the creative power which brings forth the universe. Now then, as and when man purifies the whole psychophysical organism, he enables this transformation of consciousness to take place. So we see the fundamental importance, the indispensability for living the pure life, the moral life. And you will notice that where the actual teachings of the great spiritual teachers of the world are concerned, they didn't produce systems of philosophy. They didn't produce any political science or economic science or anything like that. They were not concerned with that. They were concerned with enabling you yourself to realize your supreme happiness, your supreme well-being, which consists in entering into that state of divine consciousness which completely subsumes every other form of consciousness. And they were the awakeners of man. They tried to awaken us to this divine state, which is the true fulfillment of what we commonly call the human state. So now, through living the pure moral life, and the teachers just laid down the same ethical teachings, to live the truly ethical life, the psyche becomes utterly pure, utterly transparent, empty of all our personal ambitions and desires and passions and all the rest of it. The electrochemical activity of the whole psychophysical organism now goes on completely purified, but no longer driving us to live in an immoral way or in any sort of evil way. And evil has so many hundreds of forms, as we all know. Hence the indispensability of the pure life. Thus, the marvel and the beauty of the simple life then emerges out of us. And as it emerges, what happens is that our vain and egoistic intrusion of our own self upon the world ceases. Then we are in complete harmony with Mother Nature in the first instance and all its processes. And correspondingly, we enter more and more into harmony with the divine. And as the divine, the transcendent, that is the infinite, the eternal and the immortal, takes us into itself, we naturally and spontaneously live the truly human life. And he who lives that truly human life knows all about the art of living humanly. It is an art which is not guided by knowledge in our ordinary sense of the word. It is truly guided by the divine itself. But one must be very careful not to be deluded that, oh, God is directing me all the time. Be very, very careful. Never say that, never think that. God knows his business. Let him do it. And you will never want for anything in consequence. But if you think that, oh, I am God's servant and serving him, you will only get terrible sorrow and pain. This transformed consciousness is, as I said yesterday, an unknowing knowing. You know what Plato said? When you really know something, you do it. Nothing to prevent you doing it perfectly and completely. It just naturally happens. That is complete knowing. And it is so complete that the brain does not analytically know what that knowing consists of. It just happens by itself, quite naturally, quite spontaneously. You see, this is something which is very difficult for us to see, to understand, and to live by it. It's unthinkable, necessarily, because every thought is something which limits the totality. And if and when the totality is functioning freely through you, how can the brain make a particular shape to say, this is how the divine is functioning? It's quite impossible. So it is an unknowing knowing. You find this idea of the cloud of unknowing, as it is called, coming in all the great religions of the world. The cloud of unknowing. And in Mahayana Buddhism, for instance, it is also called the cloud of the supreme truth. The cloud of enlightenment, of transcendent love and wisdom, of goodness and beauty. Dharma Megha, it is called. And it's an astonishing statement, isn't it? But if we happen to be fortunate enough to see even a ray of light in connection with it, we will begin to thrill to that. And when we begin to thrill to that state, then all the change that we experience in life will no longer be a fortuitous, a purposeless, or a regressive change, but it will be a progressive change. And the progressiveness will have as its source, its inspiring and formulating source, the divine mind itself, not my mind. And then the statement, thy will, not mine, be done, will just naturally take place. Because we shall never resist whatsoever happens, whatsoever comes. If we function fully and perfectly as possible to us, then it is that perfection which transforms that which is imperfect or evil. But if I try to think out, how shall I transform this evil state, or get rid of it, or break it up or destroy it and produce a better one, then I shall only pay the penalty for my conceit and make my fellow human beings also suffer in the process. These are somewhat difficult matters. I do understand that it might be difficult to penetrate into it, but if one listens sympathetically, that is, not agreeing with anything I say, at the same time don't disagree with anything I say, but just consider it carefully, just consider it, and consider it without preconceptions and assumptions, without particular standards of judgment, without special criteria, because all those are the impurity of our psyche. They are fixations And the fixation of the mind is the dis-ease of the mind. So you see, the great and true psychotherapy which one undergoes is through one's own inward process of remaining awake to all that happens. Because it is all contained, it is subsumed within the total reality. And if one remains awake to it, sensitive, then the right response will emerge from one to that particular situation or event or whatever it may be. And that is the way of transformation in the right way, because it is the way of growth, of living growth. We can never order life to make our own body or anything else grow this way and that way and that way. We can't. It's life which does it, and life is the supreme mystery, just as God is the supreme mystery, and so forth. We only interfere with that, with our particularized psychical activity, with our conditioned brains. But awake to the conditioning, and the conditioning dissolves, and you find true spiritual freedom that way. Now, when consciousness is of that nature, this unknowing, knowing state, with the psyche completely purified, then the two contexts, I say two contexts, but they are actually one, but for convenience of talking, I have to say two contexts. The context of the divine, which is the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal, is fully conjoined with the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal, which is the worldly context in which I, the ordinary living being, function. So there is this relationship between the two. We need not wonder, is there hope for us? Is there a God? Is there this? Is there not this? And so forth. What is the meaning of it all? Just observe. Observe carefully. Pay full attention throughout your waking life. And you will find that if you practice that, you will also pay full attention throughout your sleeping life. If you study the Upanishads, for instance, very carefully, or the teachings of the Buddha, you find all this revealed, that in your sleep you can be awake to truth, and a transformation process can go on. So it is this awakened state which persists throughout one's life, and in this state of being awakened, purification takes place by itself. It's the power of life, it's the power of the divine which effects the healing and the purifying. I can't purify, but that which is of a transcendent dimension can effect the purifying and the healing. Then you don't have to think out an art of living humanly. You are naturally in the state of harmony. And the art of living humanly is not my artifice, something manufactured by me, but the divine life flowing unhindered with complete cooperation from me, willing cooperation, a complete giving of myself to that divine life, and therefore I live humanly. Thank you.